Okay. So, yes.
Okay, Lucia. Do we have to identify ourselves? I'm Timothy.
I'm Lucia.
I'm Ashley again.
So I wanted to start the conversation by talking about conversation as a category or form, right, or whatever. And because obviously the name here is that these are conversations. They're like interviews, but they're not exactly interviews. And because they're also a discussion amongst disciplinary peers, there's some implication, I think, being given to that notion of conversation. And I'm curious about that because it's a very deliberate conceit about fashioning a discourse, that there are a bunch of ways of producing a discourse, presumably from publications, from academic publications to popular publications to lectures, to the built work, and so on. And so the conversation fits in somehow into that. The conversation is a particular mode. And a couple of things that struck me is that a conversation, well, first that it has some historical character, right, and that their conversation started at a certain time and it meant a certain thing,
yeah.
And it allowed people to talk in a certain way with a kind of open-endedness. And I'm wondering if that means the same thing now, or should we take this term very casually, or should we really think about what conversation is or should be in architectural discourse? Now, there have been a few kind of volleys launched in this direction from the people arguing in favor of gossip, the increase in gossip, arguing for an increase in a kind of quick way, rapid way of talking about architecture, the notion of passionate criticism, and so on. So how does conversation fit into that, and do these actually count as conversations? And are they open-ended enough to be conversations? Are they different from interviews? Are they providing the kind of definition of terms that could be kind of to create a glossary of ideas, or are they a snapshot, more kind of journalistic account or a record of a moment?
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about the talk of the town, and that's more the vision that I have of it, that it's not anything that gives you a greater sense, avowedly anyways, but by their own questions, and that you can today ask the question, you know, I guess the questions you had asked them to ask each other were very sort of metaphysical, like, are you a generation? Who are your peers? It's a really sort of a synchronic cut, or wants a synchronic cut, but that it's possible today to have, there are many forms in which those cuts occur, but don't yield a major metaphysical insights, such as like the talk of the town, that's a snapshot. So I think snapshot is the right word, that it does, there are certain questions you know to ask, and nobody's shocked that they're asked. So it's not like if you were to ask a Beaux-Arts architect, are you part of a generation? That would be like a revolution because, you know, the masters were the masters, and then when Viollet-le-Duc came and said, I am a new generation, that shook up the entire establishment. So the idea of generation is not shocking, but nobody's coming up with some major redefinition of yes. Today, this is what it means to be a generation. So I do think that the conversations as we kind of heard them are definitely sort of, this is what's happening right now, a very snapshot and internalized discourse, I have to say. I mean, we can talk more about internal versus external, but certainly not a conversation I would have as someone who is right now not designing anything.
And are they, in that sense, too, not too, but are they, are they essentially self-affirming? I mean, is that the conversational mode that happens here? And would that be any different in a staged debate? I'm trying to think of these other, the kind of, say, some recent historical equivalents of the conversation. The debate is obviously one.
Right.
And that, you know, you think of the staged debates from the Institute period. You think of even the Skyline interviews that often took the form of debates, or some of the things in London.
I mean, I guess what struck me is that, and I've had a conversation with a few of the people who are in the interviews about this, that the position that they take, and this has partly to do with how much what you were discussing before we started this interview about the insistence that they're building and not just doing sort of speculative work, it's a pretty normative architectural position. Basically, they want to be professionals, they want to be architects, and their position is therefore that, okay, architects, insofar as they're professionals, they talk to one another, and this is not a very it's a pretty free form of conversations. Just people who do the same thing talk to one another, which is relatively different from how it's been. Certainly, in, you know, there are other models going on, but like in the 20th century, you had you know, the Bauhaus, which is very much like a pedagogical model, like you teach and you disclaim and you manifest and all that stuff. And then there's the kind of Siemens, which takes that manifesto moment to the broad scale. And that is a group. Like, there's many kinds of grouping. And then you mentioned the Institute model, which is based upon this, like, super polemical mode. And it doesn't strike me that the professional model that they have comes with a form of discourse, particularly, which is maybe why the discourse is then so informal.
Well, except maybe to the extent that the discourse, to take this professional stance is, for this group anyway, already a kind of polemic. It's a reactionary moment, at least the way they describe
right.
it. We're not like the people who came before
yeah,
us.
Yeah, we're not the autonomy people.
We're not the autonomy people. We're not the paper architects
right.
we want to build. And so that's, although I agree that it does strike a normative position, it is at least being set against something. And so to the extent that it's a position being set against a prior position, does it amount to discourse? I mean,
oh, sure.
enters into it.
And,
sure.
and what is a normative position anyway?
Well, a normative position in this case, I mean, I don't know what your definition would be, but from what you're saying, I think the normative position here is that it's adopting a set of known roles, a set of known practices that have recurred in architecture since, well, if you say Albertian.
I mean, it's like an Albertian model of multidisciplinary. It's very familiar. So it's not, you know, like in the Institute days, they borrowed very specifically and kind of with much difficulty a model that was existing in institutes and research, etc. And there are some people who today, who are not, you know, part of this conversation right now, who are adopting that model again, like the research model, their lab model. Mm. There are people who are taking a very political position, like an activist position, and those models take adaptation. I'm not saying it's better or worse, it's just that insofar as that's what their discourse requires them to do, I guess.
Uh-huh.
I'm not saying they want to be normative, but it just so happens that maybe because of what they want to do, which is very material or whatever, they end up occupying a pretty traditional sort of Renaissance architect as interdisciplinary subject.
Right, with the valence of expertise. So
yeah.
I mean, that's what reinforces it or makes it apparent now as a kind of normative position is that there's a claim to a specific kind of expertise, and several of them refer to this, the idea that you can kind of organize and coordinate
yeah, yeah.
different roles, that you're capable of interpreting codes, you know, for everything from the building code to material technologies and so
yeah,
on.
Yeah, the idea that you can inhabit multiple contexts, that you have audiences who are clients, audiences who are in schools, audiences who are, I mean, maybe the most obvious way to say it is that even though it's very clear that this is a very specific group of architects who is associated with teaching and with schools, that's not the position they're adopting. They're not teacher architects, which at a certain time,
in these particular conversations, at least, they're not willing to admit that. Right?
Yeah, but
well,
that's
and they,
fine.
And they walk away from it.
Right.
I mean, in some cases, where they say we specifically don't want to write manifestos.
Yeah.
You know, we don't. we see our students as peers, not as people who are actually sort of shaping in some particular way. In some cases, the students are seen or are presented as people or talked about as people who have a kind of expertise already, that they have a fluency that these practitioners
yes, exactly.
themselves need,
right.
you know, which is already collapsing this kind of pedagogical standard
right.
in a way.
I do think that it's a cultural stance that they're taking. I don't mean to imply
yes.
that this is a retreat in any way. In fact, I think they do see it as a step forward in that maybe as a reaction to sort of over-specialization, to the point that each of your students now is potentially specialized in one thing or another, that the architect actually is not a bad model for claiming a variety of expertise. So definitely a
yep.
position that has cultural resonance.
Oh, absolutely. But I'm curious about whether this position arises specifically because of, well, at least in part because of this form of the conversation. If any one of them
oh,
was interviewed alone,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
If the editors had interviewed
sure,
any
no.
of them just in isolation, would the same kind of sensibility become apparent? Or is it part of the conversational mode, part of the discussion amongst peers that leads to this kind of, what we're referring to anyway is the normative position, but also that leads to this clear statement of a reaction against this prior thing,
yeah.
of architecture and autonomy and so on.
Well, I think that's the setup. I mean, the setup is, if there's any oppositional at all. So, for example, it's not a fight. There's no
yeah.
debate. There's no. They do different things, but many of them, I was struck with how willing they are to aggregate amongst one another and to say, yeah, we do the same thing. And maybe you can set up the next issue, people who actually truly disagree with one another, not just in terms of you know, ideology, but actually that they do different things. Like, I think architecture should be activism. There are people who do that.
Yeah.
And so some of the sort of neutrality would disappear.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
Can I ask one? I don't want to interject too much, but you had said something about the, you know, the question of generation would be revolutionary for the Bauhaus. What would you think a revolutionary question would have been to ask these? What question wasn't asked? Or what could... I don't know. I mean, maybe you don't have an answer.
Well, I have one answer, which, thinking of the Bauhaus, what I was struck by was how relatively modest, either modest or unwilling, all of them were in describing the current cultural, political, social context. You spoke to someone in the Bauhaus, they wouldn't simply say, this is what architecture is. They would say, this is what the world is. Mm-hmm. Right? And there's a mention of Obama and the inaugural address. There's a couple of mentions of the crisis, the economic crisis. There's no specificity there, and there's no explicit claim about politics, say. You know, none of these architects identify themselves as political actors. None of them say who they voted for. There's an assumption, right, that we all know they're all left-leaning. But is that true, you know, really? And what does that mean? Are some of them very on one edge of the political spectrum? Are some of them in the middle of it? Equally, culturally or socially, there's no discussion of that. And I think to answer your question, the question I might have posed, or in retrospect you could pose, is what's the problem today? What are you actually trying to do? Not you as architect, but what needs to be done?
What needs to be done?
Right. You know, because the Bauhaus had plenty of words and articles and lectures to that question. What needs to be done? And it wasn't simply what needs to be done in architecture. It's what needs to be done.
Well, we did ask what needs to be done to keep architects relevant in this. That was one of the questions.
But even the phrasing of that, I think, leads them into this kind of modesty. I'm just trying to keep up. I'm just trying to make myself relevant.
I mean, I think that's partly maybe to transition into the question of criticism, which is that the way this is maybe what they expect from the critic, right? That there's an expectation. These are, to the extent that I'm friends or know these architects, many of them are people with whom I've had conversations about, I've heard from them that there's a need for new critics, in the same way that there's this idea that it needs to be a new generation, and it needs, I guess, to correspondingly be a new generation of critics. And that strikes me as something that it's a kind of receptive position. Like, I do something, now you respond. And that's in a way, to not have to articulate yourself what the consequences of your own actions are, which is fine. It's not like, I mean, I wouldn't say the Bauhaus, I think the Bauhaus got burned for saying what the consequences were going to be and then having them not pan out.
Sure.
But in a certain sense, the desire for a critic to sort of respond to what you're doing means that you're not really examining the mode by which you're operating.
Mm-hmm. If criticism, in just a very general sense, is just the role of the act of explaining stuff, explaining things, then there wasn't a very deliberate statement about how or why things should be explained. There was, again, a kind of reservation, I think, or is a reservation. Part of that's the structure and the topics that were being discussed, but it seemed to me what they wanted to talk about with each other, the two themes that came up, I think, in all of them were, first, how do you make decisions? How do you guys make decisions? When you design, where do you stop? Do you do research? What is research? Why should we not call it research? Things like that. And then the second set was, how do you define consequences or consequentiality? This is like the relevance question again. How do you demonstrate that you're relevant, or how do you prove that you make that you have some consequence, that the work that will do something that you say it will do? And there, in that, they all pose that question. A few of them really answered it, and I think that is where they're deferring to something we could call criticism, you know, whether it's done by critics or whether it's done simply by people who use architecture or engage in other ways, or by clients. There's a kind of backing off there where they don't offer a specific model of explanation, or they don't seem to claim it. And again, this is a kind of counter maybe to a prior generation where there are some instances anyway where there's a very clear program of setting up a kind of apparatus of explanation in advance of the work
right.
or next to the work,
right.
you know, or follows the work. So the participants here actually seem to be leaving some room between their work and the models
That's
of explanation
true.
Around it.
So you're saying as a kind of generous gesture, actually.
Yes,
right,
yes.
That it's it can be perceived as it, you know, as you will.
Right. I can call it modesty, and I think that's right. I mean, I think it may be a reluctance. It may be a kind of other. Their motivations differ for the different participants. But I think it can be received as a kind of generosity if there is in fact the looseness there. If they are in fact giving over the possibility of larger explanations of their work. The real test of that, though, comes when they're actually subjected to real criticism.
Well, yeah, that's the question, because
they are
asking for criticism, not in, you know, these tapes, but...
No, but they've asked you and I specifically.
They've asked us, and, like, that's part of why we're sitting
times.
Here, is because these are people who regularly ask us to do criticism, and criticism is a lot of work, and this makes you uncomfortable, because we, as critics, or as, like, someone who writes, you're taught... The previous generation is the generation that sort of had... issues with writing about their friends, because you have to do it, but then they're your friends. And Tim and I had this idea for a column which would be called Blank is a Friend of Mine, and it would come out every whatever in a magazine, and you would just choose the friend that you're writing about. But then you would do the right job. You would actually do the criticism. The question is, of course, it's very risky to do criticism, because I was just rereading this Alan Colquhoun piece from 1977, and he actually says, in my opinion, this is... a mistake. They use the word error, mistake. In my opinion, this is like risky for the critic and basically, frankly, risky for the architect. I'm not sure some of these people want to hear what my criticism will be. You know, that there's a kind of engagement. So that's one thing. The other thing is that it seems to me that it's not just criticism that is wanted. It's that there's certain institutional channels for young architects who are taking this position of being practitioners that are necessary, even if you're taking this kind of realist position that we're just going to practice and build buildings, mm-hmm. that you have to be in schools teaching and that you have to be in museums showing somehow. And those are two forms of criticism that very much exist, are institutionalized, and the idea that you need a new generation is, it's like in architecture. It's not like you need a new generation. There are just new ones born every year, new ones formed and trained, and then museums now have departments which need to be sustained, which need to have shows, and so there's a kind of machine. I mean, I tend to see things in institutional terms, but there's a machine that keeps these changing, and so to speak of generations is a little bit like...
But you think that even just the act of a museum collecting is a form of criticism?
Sure, of course, yeah. Curatorial. In America, the curatorial form of criticism has been the strongest. That's almost native to the American context. Not going back to the Enlightenment, but the whole MoMA, and that's based on a very specific idea of what museums should have as a social mission. So it's not just architecture. It's just museums were a type of education, a type of ethical orientation of the public.
So your definition then of criticism is actually really quite broad.
Well, right now, in this part of this conversation, it is.
Okay.
Right? At this point, I would still say criticism is just the act of explanation, right? Some present object comes to attention, has some significance in the present moment, and it gets explained.
Well, I think present is the right important thing.
So in that case,
thing.
The institution is criticism, a journal like Praxis is criticism,
yes.
and a museum is criticism,
yes.
just in the fact that it's selecting one thing over another.
And to that, selection is one of the forms.
But it's also establishing explanatory rules through that process of selection.
There's sort of sites of conversations, and I think present is the right word just in terms of making a distinction with history, which is, you know, our day job is being historians, and that's a different type of explanation and commentary. I mean...
Yeah.
I was recently talking about, with someone who shall remain unnamed, about whether or not there's a salon culture in architecture.
What?
Salon, you know, the salon,
the
18th century
salon.
And he took great offense at this, and I think because he thought I was accusing him of being part of the salon, but to which he accused me of being part of the machine, so that's even worse. You said you yourself are part of the machine. But in any case, what I was trying to say was this. There is a critical culture in architecture. Like, the whole idea that you and I don't want to call ourselves critics because we don't really do criticism. We don't write criticism every week for a newspaper. We don't do it, you know, in the sort of maybe the more constricted sense that you're describing, that you're thinking of. On the other hand, we're asked all the time to go to reviews. We were just at a conference called Criticism. Somebody thought we qualified. Mm-hmm. And that really stands apart from other disciplines. Like in sociology, there are not juries. There are not critics. There are peer reviews, but that's an academic thing. If you look at the difference between a thesis done by an undergrad or a PhD and a thesis done by an MArch, the thesis done by the undergrad is defended. It's like a legal model. Mm-hmm. You stand up there, you make an argument, you defend it. The thesis done by an MArch, they stand up there and then people talk. That's conversation, that's a salon, that's criticism. And so that's how I meant about the salon, that it's like you have the thesis model, which is university-based, but you also have this idea that you just put things up on the wall and then you talk.
Mm-hmm. When you talk with the kind of, what are the other factors? You talk with a shared vocabulary. You have a glossary. A salon has a glossary, right? It's got its terms. In the sense, it also has its slang, right? And you need that kind of aspect.
And it has a specific history, like a condensation of history. Like the last salon, this happened. Last year at thesis reviews, it was like this.
Right. But also, the salon is not entirely, a kind of self-reflexive thing. It's always, its purpose or its potential is always to be responsive to some larger social condition,
right?
Absolutely. I mean, you're talking about not just a question of fashion, but, who should the king be beheaded or not?
Absolutely.
I mean, there are larger, more significant questions. And I'm not sure that thesis and the reviews seem almost like a practice salon or a sort of junior salon in that.
Right. The Diderot story is that basically nobody saw the paintings that he was writing about because nobody could come to Paris, but then he wrote about them and he sent them out as letters, and that's what created the kind of effervescent discourse that eventually turned into the French Revolution, or so the art historians like to think. But there's definitely an idea that it has greater political significance, which I'm not sure that we could attribute to thesis reviews necessarily.
No, I mean, but then the question is, can we attribute it in these conversations either, right? Given the sort of backing away from more explicit either political claims or even political discussions or cultural discussions. I mean, it seems, in addition, that we have the people that we call critics now are also increasingly, their audience is inside the discipline, not outside the discipline, right? If you think of, there's not Ruskin, there's not Greenberg, right?
There's not even Gideon.
There's not even Gideon, and somewhere around Robin Evans is when the critic actually becomes a pedagogue, right? Those figures actually become academic figures, becomes Rowe, Evans, and so on, and then their audience is really internal to the discipline. That's not, again, inherently negative or bad thing, but it's a different thing in terms of changing the salon into something that's more of a kind of internalized conversation that's insulated in some way from the surroundings.
Yeah, but I wonder how much of that is just a kind of overall specialization. Everything became a discipline. The anthropologists used to go out and, visit so-called primitive cultures, and now they sit in universities and write books about interdisciplinarity. And, the architects used to, consult with a king, and now they sit in universities and write memos to... I mean, maybe that's a kind of simplification, but it strikes me that the pedagogical turn, the university turn, that's something that all disciplines have kind of undergone. I don't know.
Yeah, and I'm not interested in kind of...
how would architecture go out of that?
Right, and I'm interested in how architecture could go out of that, and I'm not interested in it going back. Like, when we talk about criticism, thinking of the issue of JAE on criticism, there's a lot of nostalgia for Clement Greenberg, for this model of criticism. There's a nostalgia for every newspaper in the country having an architecture critic, and that person be someone who's kind of trained, maybe did an undergraduate degree in architecture, they sort of know something about it. But they're not professionalized. They don't have friends. They can still be impartial. So there's a kind of appeal for that. We need this place. We need this. And I'm not sure that we do. I mean,
issue of JAE is definitely focused on that sort of Anglo-Saxon tradition of the Ruskin that eventually became the newspaper critic.
Right. Right. And they want to go back to it and somehow re-amplify it because that's a dying trend. And then there's the academic critic, and there's a desire to perpetuate that, to anoint the next, internal academic critic figure,
right?
The next person who will get a tenure on the basis of criticism.
Of criticism, right?
That will be the next figure. But surely there are other routes out of that, and it doesn't have to be a route out, but just ways of expanding the conversation about architecture, so that it's not so either relentlessly susceptible to an academicizing model, nor is it simply out there in the world.
Well, two things. One thing is that the curatorial model definitely seems the one that's most up for grabs right now. That there are more, like it's a growth industry or whatever the word would be. That there are more and more departments that need more and more architecture to be hung or bought or whatever.
Yeah, more galleries exhibiting architecture.
Yeah, and also that it seems like a model that even in the PhD programs is now used as a training model. Like it's actually a pretty rigorous way to process information, to learn, to write, etc., in a way that criticism just isn't taught. And so the independent curator, which is something that's happening in art a lot right now, like the people who are sort of free agents in curatorial, and they go collecting people, and they are not necessarily associated with an institution, but have ties to them, I think that's probably something that we're going to see more of. Mm. I can think of a few people who are getting PhDs who that's actually what they want to do. Mm-hmm. And then similarly, I would say that in the historians category, we've now passed, well, we think as historians that we've passed the moment where that's completely, where we have nothing to say to designers that wouldn't be, genealogically based, let's say. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I'm not sure the designers are ready to hear any form of history that's not genealogical. Like you and I talked about this after the criticism conference, that We a lot of us were proposing material that was in some sense historical, I mean, very recent history. And some of us were presenting it as, dead projects, like history. But anything that was in any way connected through some sort of genealogy to contemporary practice, that was the only way to understanding it was kind of...
That was the
I think we have some work to do.
The kind of commentary response was to force the genealogical model, but that seems to have overwhelmed criticism as well. I mean, that the criticism is it's not this larger explanation. Criticism is about establishing
who taught the
genealogy first, and then demonstrating the continued relevance of that genealogy in the present moment.
Right. Well, that's a bit cynical. I mean, it's also because the genealogy happens to coincide right now with the discipline.
Yes. No, that's true.
It's not just like people were trying to stay in power or something.
No. That this is the lineage kind of from the 60s forward. The genealogy.
Right. Genealogy is discipline.
The genealogy, the discipline is the turn to genealogy.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I was reading. It seems to me like each of these forms of practice carry with them a kind of critical model that we should be able to somehow sniff out what is the appropriate conversation. Like, to go back to conversation.
So if the autonomy group had the genealogical...
Oh.
The autonomy would have had genealogical criticism, right?
I guess so,
It's all about the sequence of formal problematics that are internal
to discipline. That's good, actually. That's not what I meant, but that's very good.
Criticism would, of that project...
So genealogy is the critical project that came with it.
With the autonomy.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so absolutely. So now if it's this expansive mode of practice where it's about a kind of precise engagement,
it's both
the pragmatics, the built, but it's also this kind of what they describe as the impure practice that they're willing to engage, have projects, have architecture be distorted in some way. You know, what comes along with that as a kind of...
Well, I mean, it strikes me that it's very sort of, it's back to the experiment, the whole idea of experimentality. I was rereading because I had to teach it, Hobbes Leviathan. And then because of that, I was rereading the book Leviathan and the Air Pump, which is basically about this debate between the scientist who invented the idea of the vacuum and the natural philosopher who basically legitimized monarchic rule. And there's a reason those two had a debate. And the debate was about truth, like matters of fact. All the stuff that these people talk about, kind of, right? The idea of truth, what is the claim to truth? Is it experimental? Or is it natural philosophy? And there's a reason those two discourses, which today we would think of as completely heterogeneous, talk to each other. They had somehow sort of equivalent truth claims. And it seems like architecture should be able to sniff out what other discourse they can talk to. So if it's not about an internal talking to your peers or your fathers or just to the other guy who's doing the same thing as you.
Right.
Like, how do you hold your exacto knife or something? If it's not that, then there must be some discourse that sort of that with which architecture can resonate.
Mm-hmm.
I just keep thinking about the idea that to us those two discourses are just not equivalent, but there's a reason the guy who invented the vacuum, the guy who said the body politic is a body, we're somehow talking about the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, what would the speculation be then for now? I mean, you'd want to see some people from these this other discourse, discipline, and activity actually coming and talking to architecture about architecture.
Right.
Right. Not repeat the process of the discipline sending out little probes, right, and trying to see if it gets a ping back and if this discipline's, but actually invite other disciplines to talk and participate in architecture. But what would those be? I mean, obviously there would be the technical
for evaluating which is the one that somehow resonates, right?
Well, I guess the term for it, the evaluation would be the success. I mean, I would do it to continue pragmatism. I mean, they're doing small p pragmatism to turn into big p pragmatism.
Yeah, it works. Yeah.
If it has a consequence, then it's true, right?
Well,
it's true. So, in terms of initial set of experiments or just attempts at understanding what this kind of extra disciplinary position might be,
right,
and who might be the people to talk about it or write about it. I mean, I think there are cues in some of the interviews. I was struck by things like the referencing to open source, the idea of open source and open source technology. There is resonance there. I mean, that's taken now just as a cultural, slang or cultural byword, and I assume it's also meant in a kind of technical sense. But there's a resonance there with how architecture could act and be a public activity or create public objects that are more susceptible to use and reuse and so on. So that open source could be one concept under which architecture might engage other disciplines. It's not clear that open source, though, is really any longer affiliated to computation or a specific kind of model. It's actually quite similar to other scientific models, though, as well, of propagating knowledge.
But again, with the scientific model, I don't know about that many experiments because, I occupy an interdisciplinary position right now, and it's very time-consuming to have interdisciplinary conversations. It's worth it, but I wouldn't say I want to, on any given day, pick which colleague I'm going to have a three-hour-long conversation because they don't understand what the problem is with Frank Gehry or whoever,
right.
Now I have to be on record saying there's a problem with Frank Gehry. There's no problem with Frank Gehry. But just in terms of experimental procedure, that definitely seems like a model that's growing and one that... So you would want to talk to somebody who knows something about some technical... That has a technical... A way to evaluate technical discourses, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
Because that would give you both the open source stuff, but also the sustainability and the... There seems to be a kind of coalescence to that. And there it seems to me that the model of discourse or falsifiability and all that is very undeveloped in architecture. Like, there's just this idea that if you act like a scientist, then there's either it works or it doesn't work, or not in the pragmatist sense that it works or doesn't work, but in the scientific sense. And that's as naive as, the Bauhaus thought the workshop was a laboratory. I think we have a lot of scholarship that says scientists experiment in really particular ways. It's ad hoc, but it's very particular. And it seems to me that talking to people who know about that would have something to say about the architects. And for the architects to examine their own practices that way also would be to codify what their technique is, and not in a way that's formal, not like I'm interested in tectonics or whatever, but like I use this tool and then I do this and then.
Well, also I'm not emphasizing the production side of the equation here either. I think in arguing for or trying guess to suss out what the extra disciplinary dimensions could be, in the sense that I think architects know how to do architecture, and that's fine. They should just keep doing it. But who's responsible for explaining architecture? To come back to criticism, it's not you and I. So if you are inviting someone from without to explain it, who would that be? How would they do it? How would they do it well? And wouldn't architecture benefit from that? If the genealogical model of criticism comes alongside or is inseparable from the autonomy model of criticism, then this kind of extra, this mode of pure practice, or impure practice that these guys are talking about, presumably they would say the explanation shouldn't come from us.
Right.
The explanation comes from the person who can really describe all these conditions outside. Right.
But you're saying they shouldn't look for critics inside of the...
They shouldn't be asking us to be their critics.
Right.
You know, if
they should ask people who know nothing about... I think what you
who
get
know everything about the outside.
Right. But there's nobody who knows everything about the outside. I think that's the issue is that you, specificity is everywhere, even in the outside.
Sure, but you can think of plenty of writers, critical writers,
yeah.
critics, who write about things from with some disciplinary perspective, yes, that they were trained in. So they know one part of the outside, but they're talking about very different
kind of categories
of things.
But again, just as a caveat, I really get the feeling that architecture does criticism better than a lot of... I mean, not because anybody's a critic, but architecture does criticism more regularly anyways than a lot of other disciplines to whom the whole post-critical predicament, for example, was, you know, that was struck by the whole post-critical predicament. Like, literary criticism and science studies, etc. The post-critical for them means something completely different because they don't go and sit on reviews and be critics every half of the semester. And not to say the architect is, I guess I'm sounding like these guys now, the architect is Alberti after all, but I just don't know that you would want someone to actually just represent the outside. I would want it to be more of a sort of a specific dialogue, like specificities that happen to have broader resonances.
Sure, and also, since we're on record, I would want to go on record as saying the whole inside-outside is of
the
course, an absurd fiction, right?
Yeah, the whole inside-outside, sure.
I mean, that's just, it's a shorthand way of talking about something. There's not inside, there's not outside.
Right.
You know, there are different ways of just producing objects and explaining those objects, but there's a set of terms or a glossary that you adopt, both in the production and then certainly in the explication of those objects, and the glossary has a certain location, a certain... you know, background to it, and I'm arguing that there's a kind of diminishing return to continuing to use the same glossary that we've had, and to continue to simply perpetuate that glossary, try to add a few terms to keep it up to date. When, you know, it can go on, it can continue, but there are other avenues to open up. You know, if I read. Well, any number of critics, like you read Terry Castle, who writes, you know, an English lit professor but writes about cultural issues, or Dahlia Lithwick, the legal professor, or the legal, the woman who writes about legal affairs for Slate magazine and sometimes does op-eds and things. She writes about culture, she writes about film, she writes about books, but from this perspective, or from a kind of perspective or kind of sensibility, those are different glossaries, and they can talk about cultural events. If these practitioners are arguing that their architecture is participating in the world in a kind of built, functional, active way, then it's presumably susceptible to those glossaries as well, and that it can be described, explicated, consequences perhaps can be better explicated with those glossaries.
Right.
If they're concerned for consequences, as I think they are in reading through or listening to the interviews, then I think they need a different glossary.
But do you think that then they would have to sort of give up the... It seems to me like there's a kind of tension between how these architects are trained and what they're trained to say. Like, they know exactly what autonomy means. When they say autonomy, that refers to a specific group of people, and that's an internal discourse. But then, on the other hand, they are experts in a variety of different things, like this microchip became cheaper at a certain time and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Would you have to give up one, essentially, in order... Because it seems to me pretty clear that one is subordinate to the other in these discussions, that they see themselves as having a larger mandate, which has to do with autonomy, let's say, like a disciplinary mandate, and then they have sort of... They're inventing tools or something like that.
Well, it maybe comes back to this question of the museum and the gallery and so on, because I think some of that is forced on them by their academic settings. All right, you could say, what if they didn't teach? Then would they be required to talk about autonomy anymore, or could they just forget that? Is that something that's actually forced by the academic context? So say they didn't teach, that would there still be some kind of compulsion because of publications, because they're in praxis, because they need to exhibit certain places to participate in that, use that also as a background to their work or part of the explanatory model of their work?
Would they be talking at all, basically?
Would they be talking at all?
But you're also setting up teaching as something that, like, as if they have to do that to supplement the practice. But I think for some of these people, teaching is... It's integrated with the practice, right? I don't think they see that as, I have the making, and then, I have to go, in my studio, so I have to come up with something to say that fits into the kind of discourse.
No, but it's pretty clear that if you're building the things that these people are building, you don't have to say the word autonomy to get it built.
Right.
But you have to say the word autonomy to teach a bunch of MRs because that's how the discourse is set up. It's not a critique, I don't think.
No, not at all. No, I think they're all, or most of them are all, most of them are good teachers, right?
Right.
The ones whose teaching I know are good teachers.
Right.
But I do think that a certain kind of baggage comes along with that, obviously, and that limits, or it doesn't limit, but it puts a kind of bias on the explanatory structures
right.
that get wrapped around their work.
I mean, I was struck, actually, by how little discussion of media there is, especially considering how much teaching happens about media, and not just, you know, computer media, but also in terms of history. Like, a lot of teaching about history, recent history, is about how architecture became a medium, etc. And criticism is something that is applied to, most criticism is about film and television and now the internet, etc. It seems to me like architecture should get in there and that you would be able to have some discourse that bridges the two, the internal and the external discourse. This is what I was thinking, that when you go to reviews, clearly the students are looking at media, both digital and sort of cinematic, and so are the critics, but that's not part of the discourse in any way.
Mm-hmm.
So I was kind of surprised by that. Another one, I can't remember.
I just don't understand, are you saying this is already a kind of exteriority that's already built into the way we're operating now, that just that we're not talking about, we're not adopting those glossaries? And those
I'm just looking for a bridge between, something to break down the idea, because of course autonomy contains the idea of inside, outside, and you would want to somehow get past that.
And they're still, because they're still the generation that's reacting against that autonomy generation, they still use its terms, right? That's why they say, we're not this, we're that, and there's clearly, I'm interested to hear more about how their students talk, right? And what their students are bringing into their practices, because their students are probably a step beyond that.
Yes, exactly. This is very informal.
Or they're just,
I mean, I feel this is really, this is a very informal discussion that contains so many codified words that if you actually ask them to keep a journal, which is what a lot of those websites look like what they do, who they talk to, it's the proportion of words that have to do with let's say media versus the proportion of words that have to do with autonomy, I think would be reversed probably.
Oh yeah, I think if you did the textual or what the linguistic analysis or
semiotics,
if you did the bloggy version would just be the word cloud, right? Run it through, do the word cloud for the issue.
We've done some word clouds for the issue, we can show you.
Okay.
You have? Oh my god. And what are the words?
Well, we haven't edited it yet, so we'll tell.
So the words that come up are, like, because it was, or think,
We haven't gone through and edited the transcripts yet, so, but we'll leave this, we'll pretend as if we had,
and then you'll put it,
and
then we'll have no reaction whatsoever.
Yeah.
Interesting. You can write a reaction.
Well, we can guess. I mean, I think you're right, media is not in there. Right.
Yeah, it's very strange.
Performance is
in there,
which is their word for consequence.
Very particular,
And consequentiality. Autonomy is in there, definitely.
I think practice is in there.
And practice, yeah.
I wasn't there.
Okay, well, we should add an addendum, insert something, because that will be revealing.
We'll send it to you, and you can react.
I guess.
For the sake of not feeling super frustrated, sorry, finish your thought, I'm just going to ask if you could, off the record or moving away from the linear time frame, just give me like a 3-minute summary of what the...
What we said?
Where you began, at least, or what the... No, not what you said, but just sort of what...
First, we talked about the nature of conversation,
okay.
What that meant.
We talked about institutions. We enlarged the word criticism to include most forms of institutionalized discourse about architecture, including museums and schools and journals.
Things that are about the present.
And then we discussed various models of collectivity in architecture during the 20th century, which contained forms of criticism, such as the Institute had its debates, the CMs had their Gideon, the Bauhaus. What did the Bauhaus have?
As structures.
I mean,
pedagogy,
right?
Yeah.
But that's not, like, when the Bauhaus came here, sorry, it's kind of a sidetrack, but...
It was plenty of...
The crit system we have, that's the Beaux-Arts model, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's competitions, jury, winner.
Mm-hmm.
When the Bauhaus came, they changed a lot of things, but they somehow didn't change that. Like the,
no,
that's why it's still kind of a salon model. It's kind of a... we talked about the salon.
Right, and so a hierarchical salon model. Yeah.
Or can we say CM somehow is
well,
a...
Well, and I still think
would be
part
another
of
one,
the
yeah.
Bauhaus model is, I mean, it's changed from parti to idea, but there's still this sense in the creation of a design, right? That in the Bauhaus model, it was you handed in your parti within 12 hours, you went away and came back.
The Beaux-Arts. The Beaux-Arts model, yeah.
Yeah, sorry. But now it's just, it's the idea, right? You have the idea that somehow comes out of your first kind of research, and at the end, I'd say 80% of students are still presenting, well, you know, I did this and this and this in the beginning, and see, now my project is a manifestation of...
But see, I think that's really interesting, the idea of research, or anyways, the idea that it's about the process, which for a while was, you know, a kind of aesthetic, and there was an idea that it had to do with a certain literariness and stuff. But it's back, and it's not because of a literary conceit. It's because of a kind of scientific, experimental, you know, obligation. And I do think that we're going to have to figure out some way to make evaluations, critical evaluations, based on something that takes a sort of scientific, you know, discourse as a model, because there's all these issues that are coming up that require architects to engage the world in these sort of technical ways. And I just don't think we figured that out. Like, and we know a lot about laboratories. Historians write about them. Historians write about, sociologists write about scientists and how they do things. And the truth claims definitely are not just pure, you know, truth claims. So there has to be some way that, to me, that's interesting. And it's not just a perversion of, you know, the Bauhaus sort of workshop model.
No, and it's an expansion in the sense that now the obligation is for any student to learn how to discover things and then learn how to invent things. And those weren't necessarily contiguous activities previously, right? You were learning to invent things,
right.
Or you could learn how to discover things.
Right,
but now you're discovering and invent. And this that's why all these practitioners are so, their main question to each other is how do you make decisions? Right, and that to me is again just shorthand for this same problem.
Right.
We look at stuff. We do research. We don't do research except when we talk about it. Actually, sounds what I would call research.
Yeah.
You know, there are various kind of hedgings on that, but basically they do research. They look at stuff. Then they make decisions about how to work with it. Then they create. Then they make more decisions. And they want to know from each other how do you make decisions about process.
Yeah.
And I think it is because none of that's now all of it's in flux or it's not encoded. I guess my question would be, is criticism, or are there modes of criticism that can actually help that process? Is there something to be learned there? Or is this something that will get decided in practice through successful and non-successful activities and practices, and then criticism will learn how to do it? Because in some way, we're asking students to do a lot of criticism.
Yeah.
Early on in a given design problem. You're saying, go, you know, make a judgment about some condition in the world. And then react to it, and then make some architectural response that's keyed to your reaction. But that's
one of the things that's interesting about research, again, from the point of view of institutions, is that research is a model where you convince someone that you deserve support, and then you do the research. And this is something that the late 20th century institute model had, and some of the labs that are being formed in various universities have now, and centers, et cetera, that you basically apply for grants. And then you... So it's about sort of getting... It's not so much getting criticism, it's getting support that is the type of discourse.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that has a codifying spin to it. So you can't just say anything. You have to say something that convinces someone that what you're looking for is actually interesting.
Yeah, so it's already coordinated to their expectations.
Yeah,
certainly,
and
that's the science grant model.
But also the political model that I think the people who are dealing with activism decide to talk. It's a different model of effectivity, but it's also, you also go look for, you know, an NGO to support you or NGOs go look for certain grants to do certain things. So it seems to me that there needs to be more of an, I mean, or this is also what, you know, Latour talks about in this very particular way, the idea that, you know, science is a tribunal and that it's a public process, that, you know, scientific objects need to be represented in the political sense of representation in the same way as people are represented. This is all something that makes a link between advocacy and research, let's
mm-hmm.
say. And it seems to me that there are some people who are doing that.
But these practitioners are very shy about the advocacy part of that equation, right?
Well, but I mean, the scientists don't think that they're advocating, you know, a political cause. They just go to political forces to get their research supported. In other words, you don't have to
actually...
But
they begin with a problem. But they begin with a question and a hypothesis. And several of these... In several of these interviews or conversations, there's a sense that you're... That's bad. You shouldn't start with your own agenda. You shouldn't start with your own problem. You know, you might have a kind of a sense of wanting to have effect and wanting to have good effect as opposed to bad effect, but they certainly are timid about about the question of establishing certainly a manifesto or a claim or something advocacy political or otherwise. It's more about interest or interested in certain things, and then when they describe their own self qualities, they tend to be qualities, not positions.
Right,
clarity. But that's a quality. That's not a position. Right. Is that again a kind of damage from the generation that preceded them or trained them? I mean that this is anti-manifesto means that you're a person of qualities, a man of no position.
Yeah, exactly. No position. It's back to the ethical model of the Albertian. Okay. Like I have qualities. I know astrology. I know. I don't know.
Firmness. Delights.
17 disciplines he knew, Alberti, or he said the architecture. No, that's Vitruvius.
17. Vitruvius, yes.
I don't know. That's off record. Strike that. I guess I have a question for you guys. I mean, because I consider what you do criticism, and it's pretty clear that you do not have an oppositional stance towards, you know, the architects that you write about. So I guess that's a kind of curatorial model, I would say. Like something where you're like the agency to whom you write a grant proposal and you say, yes, we will support you.
Well, but the opposition is in who you don't select, right?
Sure, but there's a difference between that and articulating a critique, right? Like the explicit critique, you know, in the manner of, in my opinion, this is bunk.
Yeah.
Like nobody is saying that. And but I don't have a journal, so you're not saying that and you have a journal. Mm-hmm. Would you ever do that? You yourselves, or would you ever have an issue that was like against blank? Even if it was, I don't know, against autonomy, let's say.
I actually think the closest we came to doing that was in the first issue, where we actually came out and said that, for example, I remember saying that there was a kind of five questions, which was. Thank you. But we came out and said that there were these five questions. And it might not have been absolutely direct, but I think in asking those five questions, the use of questions rather than points, mm-hmm. was an anti-manifesto as well. But I think we explicitly came out and said things like, you know, that there would always be a clear relationship between the text and graphics. It was a refutation to a great extent of, say, for example, the graphics of Annie. I think there was an explicit... I mean, there were definitely explicit points that we made in that where we said what the journal wouldn't do, and in doing so, I think, wasn't it implicit criticism of...
But of the format that we were doing, but also of
certain practices too.
That's a form of specialization. That's funny. That's like
I think there was also saying that there were certain practices that we explicitly said that.
Well, you wouldn't be able to do that if you can't have a clear text and a clear image that relates to one another. Then you can't be public.
But it was also like, for example, that we were looking for things that were off the coasts. You know, that they were looking for practices that weren't the kind of star architects. I mean, I don't remember exactly what the wording is. So I sound more intelligent than I do right now, but...
Well, wait, to go back, but what you're suggesting, though, is that you're conflating criticism with criticality or negativity somehow.
Not conflating it, just at some point I recounted... having recently reread a piece by Alan Cahoon and others in the 60s who were completely unabashed about saying, being really critical,
right.
And that part of the reason why when I'm asked to write about various architects, first of all, it takes a lot of time, you have to do a careful job, but it's dangerous, both for the critic and for the architect.
When you say critical, you mean negative, not
Making a judgment, evaluation, and I was struck by how often these critics, the last generation of critics who were sort of relating to, just came out and said, this is not good, this is not good, in my opinion, this is not...
Right.
So,
but I think this comes back to your the kind of hunch about the kind of pseudoscientific, that moving away from that kind of personalizing way, the kind of opinion, and I have to say also, we're editors, which is different.
Right.
I mean, we write the editorial, but we don't actually... You sort of say, well, why wouldn't you? Would you ever come out and kind of be more critical?
I have to say,
our voice is actually, to my mind, is very kind of quiet within the specific voices of the writers in the issue. We don't usually, we never write the kind of theory pieces or the history pieces or even the large. I mean, with
essays. Yeah, so it's a curatorial modeling. It's an editorial model, right?
Yes.
I agree, but I also, I mean, you know, in praxis meetings, and I mean, it could happen, I suppose, but Frank Gehry, since we beat up on him once, although that was pulled off record, he's never graced the page of the Praxis, and don't think ever would, because there's a way of working there that I think is not something that we feel like was part of the trajectory of the journal, the editorial.
But you just said you are also asked to write on architects, and you, aside from the fact that it's time-consuming... there seemed to be, I think, I forget what the word you just used, you said maybe dangerous. Just because the fear of a kind of a retaliation?
Dangerous is not the word. Risk. There is risk in criticism. It's completely built
into
it.
Without risk, there isn't criticism.
Right. Without risk, it's not criticism. It's something else. And what you're describing has a risk to it. The editorial model has a risk to it. The discourse has to be, for it to be a meaningful dialogue. And that maybe that's the difference between just conversation and criticism. But for sure. Diderot now goes down in history for liking the painter who wasn't that great, and every piece on him has to start by saying, "Well, he was really into this one." Yeah, we don't know why, but his criticism's great.
And then there's the rest of the subject. I mean, this is what we were referring to earlier. So if our colleagues, friends here, were really soliciting criticism, that would mean they were adopting a certain risk that their work would be denigrated.
Do you get a sense of people ask you to write, and that in fact they're not willing to take that risk?
Yeah.
Yes.
They might be totally willing to take that risk, but they don't expect it.
Yeah.
They absolutely
but that's not
don't
what they
expect it.
Yes. And actually, I do think that came up in this issue of JE. A couple people wrote about that, right? That, and probably because if there aren't those kind of critical voices, the one critical voice then comes out as so strong because it's not kind of measured by if there's eight people writing on a firm and kind of four people, whatever. It's like the movie critic. I think a couple people mentioned that, right? If you've got 12 movie critics and eight like it and four don't, it's sort of on measure, okay, but versus if you just have one, then everybody takes that as, this is what this person said about, Michael Meredith, this is what their practice is about, or whatever, because you don't have a kind of critical mass of voices at the moment. And I think you're right, the risk is, I feel like the ante is up at this moment with a kind of lack of critical voices in architecture, that each one somehow takes on a kind of a disproportionate weight, I guess, right, because there aren't...
I think it's also unmovable. It's an offshoot of the academicization of criticism as well, because as criticism gets embedded within the academy, and is even when the individual critics are now academics, are teachers, not freelancers, then they subscribe to basically the structure of academia as well, and that has its own limitations about discourse and form and decorum and so on. I mean, certainly you can be outspoken, certainly you can criticize, but it comes along with being in the room, being in certain critical venues, being a participant in certain series sequence of lectures, and also in teaching and things like that. And so it's not that it's deadening, but it certainly makes criticism a particular. It's turned criticism into what it currently is.
Just to fill out a little more too. I do think that the very position of being an editor and allowing certain things to be, or encouraging certain things to be published. I mean, there has been risk, I would say, in praxis. There's that Hal Foster, Sanford Quinter, quite heated debate. There was a Bob McAnulty piece on the Chicago housing competition that, got me a phone call from Stanley Fireman at 8 o'clock in the morning, screaming. So, I mean, I do think that there have been moments, and the whole Hal Foster Sanford was pretty ugly at moments. So, you know, behind the scenes. So
publishing that would be problematic.
We knew it would be problematic, and we decided to publish it anyway, and decided to publish Hal's, you know, piece response to Sanford as well. So, decision to do that or not, of course, I did offer him a couple of times. I was like, are you sure you really want, you know, this published?
No, I mean, I think I don't want to give the impression to the record.
Yes. I'm not trying to be defensive
that,
either.
We're institutions are actually determining. Like, it's not because criticism is basically institutional. It's like you're a curator, you're an editor, you're a teacher, or you're, you know, a newspaper critic. That things are the way that there's a dearth of critical voices. Because on the contrary, it would seem that I think institutions take agendas very well. Like, if you show up in many of these institutions and you have an agenda and a vision, institutions respond. They receive you. And then they ask you to do all the work, but that's precisely why there's risk involved. Because are you going to stand up and be the person who has that voice, who inhabits it?
Well, I don't even think there's a dearth of critical voices so much as there's an insufficiency of variety in the critical voices. Yeah, I mean, there are positions, and as you say, from a certain level of generality, any one of us are critics that participate in the Academy, that sit on reviews and so on. But even at the more specific level, yeah, there are plenty of critics and there are plenty of people. But I don't think there's enough differentiation. And we consider the differentiation to occur, I think, or I consider the differentiation to occur basically at the level of personality. You know, he writes differently than him, she's a particular kind of writer, and so on. But the glossary is a shared glossary. You know, the viewpoint is actually within a very kind of narrow perspective, and that's where I'm wondering: is that one model of criticism that actually can give way to, or just be alongside of, some other modes of criticism that would expand the variety of critical voices, if not their numbers?
Well, again, just to take history, which is something I do more frequently than criticism, as a model, there's a huge variety of different types of historical writing right now, and the discipline's taking it very well. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of ways of writing about buildings in history and not buildings in history, and making the building spend only one line in your article versus the entire piece that you gave at this conference, which was only about the building in very great detail. And both of those things are received very well, and I think received well outside of the discipline as well, like good response from non-architects, mm-hmm. with a level of both specificity and generality with the buildings, but making large, you know, cultural claims about them. Mm-hmm. So if that's what you're sort of implying.
Well, and it was, there was at least cause for optimism from the Matter of Opinion conference, that there are these different perspectives. They're adopted right now under the mode of history, and I don't know specifically that they can translate into criticism. That was the test of that conference, to see whether these various modes of historical writing, historical thinking, could be generalized as modes of discernment, you know, modes of description, and thereby translated also into critical writing, into writing about present moments or present conditions. And maybe they can. Some of them, I'm sure, can, because they were more oriented toward the present in any case, and others probably can't. But again, those arise out of, as a kind of offspring from the main trunk of criticism, and that's why they were received with, you know, with the judgment of whether or not they corresponded successfully to the prior genealogical model. I guess I'm looking or asking for a kind of graph. Yeah. Like, isn't there just some other, aren't there good critics out there or writers that we can simply ask to start writing about architecture?
Wouldn't it be great if we had a publication that was like the London Review of Books, where people get so angry at one another about the, they're better than reading the books for sure.
Yeah, and they're angry about like medieval suites.
Oh, they are, you know, so, like, right. The debates are about issues that are quite arcane sometimes, or sometimes you would never guess that the book is very academic, because it all actually ends up being about, you know, what happened to that person last week when they were standing in line for the movies to see a blockbuster. I mean, it's really a confusion of cultural references. But those are written by very tenured people.
Yeah.
Yeah, no.
That's not how you...
No, but also by excellent writers and by people. I mean, Terry Castle referred to earlier, she writes for the LRB, and it's because she writes about culture and politics and so on, but from the point of view of a literary historian, literary.
Well, back to the question of expertise, I'm interested also in your, in the way, and if I want to understand how you're framing this, Timothy, because are you suggesting then that this kind of the broadening of the kind of the voices within architectural criticism, you're arguing for a kind of models, an exteriority, but people who are trained in other disciplines? In other words, not that there's a kind of, there would be a possibility for you and Lucia to somehow adopt a kind of exteriority, but that in fact it has to come from an expertise that's a training that's outside of our specific field, and that that would give us new terms, new glossary, new vocabulary.
I certainly think that's more likely than the former. And I think it's an opportunity for these practitioners in particular, because they know a lot of interesting people, right? It's very clear that Michael and Hillary could invite people to write about their work.
Right.
You know, Dan Amal could write and invite all kinds of people to explain their work, not us, right? And
well, I'm willing to, I don't want to reject, I don't think it's, again, it's not an interior exterior thing, and we do a lot of sort of translation to the, I mean, in my current position, I do a lot of that. I do a lot of talking about architecture to people, both in the audience, people who know a lot about it, and people don't know anything about it, and it works. I mean, not, you know, I'm not tooting my own horn. I'm just saying, as a model, it's perfectly plausible. So I don't, I see what you're saying, that conversely, you could see an external model in which architecture figures, starting from the point of view of the people who make the architecture, that you could make yourself figure in cultural discourses that don't have to go through a disciplinary model that's basically academic, that's basically about being in school again. You don't need critics in the way that you did in school.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's an either or, and so I'm not proposing a plan for how this happens.
Sure, let's do it.
I'm simply saying that within this set of conversations, there seems to be a tendency to rehearse this prior condition of criticism. And it's not a conscious tendency, it's not willful, but maybe it's because of the very deliberate positioning in disciplinary terms against the paper architecture autonomy group and so on. That there's clearly an opportunity in the way that they're thinking or practicing to change also the explanatory models with which they surround themselves. And yet, they're also, maybe because of the conversations, maybe because of their academic positions, or maybe simply because, there's a risk of rehearsing an already known way of describing, talking about, explaining architecture.
I'm curious, this may have emerged earlier, but did you find this as a commonality in the set of conversations? And that's by way of asking, did you find any kind of, any commonality at all in this? I mean, we've had, from some of our editors, been a suggestion, well, you know, how do these conversations fit together, if at all? Are there any kind of shared interests? Are there, I mean, I'm curious if you found that there was a sense of a kind of these holding together in some way.
Absolutely.
Maybe I was saying the opposite, maybe it was found, in fact, very little difference.
Yeah, I found very little difference.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was the first thing we talked about.
Okay.
You know, just, and maybe this isn't even worth being on record, but you were talking about critics from without, but you think about even the last generation of people who I think we would commonly name as the critics for the last generation, right? And many of them came from without.
Like which? So
Sanford, Jeff, even Sylvia. I mean, more art history than architecture per se, at least originally. And those are the three people, if I would, you know, again, I don't want this to be necessarily on record, but if I would say that they were the people that I call critics rather than historians of the previous generation, those
you
three
definitely
people.
Don't want that to be on record.
Yeah.
Well, I want to go on record saying one more time, I have very little patience for the generational talk. It's not.
Yeah.
It's,
no. But
this is one of the things where institutions do have more power than people with individual agendas, because institutions have schedules and they have tracks and they have, and basically they have to produce waves of people and they put them in hierarchies and if you were to actually look at people's age and the three critics that you mentioned. You know, their criticism has changed immensely over the course of their career, and it's not the case that they constitute a generation. And it's just, I just don't find it that useful. First of all, because it's always the young people who say generation, and then when they're old, they get all pissy. And
Well, the generational thing, I think it does. The illusion is that the generations are formed.
Sui generis, that they exist, like.
Yeah, and that, as opposed to being formed by situations around them, yeah. Really, when you talk about the generation of 68, right, you're not talking about these people and their actual, like, conscious activities. You're talking about the people who were alive at the time when
there was an overwhelming
set of circumstances.
It's like that thing where you're never supposed to start a paragraph in history that says, it is not a coincidence that. Yeah. Well, like, that's just not a useful claim. It's contextualist, sure.
Yeah, and so you wouldn't be saying, well, these guys kind of happen to all agree and therefore their generation. Like, you would say this is the generation that came up, that is influenced by, or that's is only made visible as a generation by X context. I mean, that would be the contextualist version.
No, I mean, it makes sense as a way to say, well, what are commonalities? There's a reason you're choosing people and you're looking for commonalities. I just don't, especially in terms of criticism, when there's so little.
But to speak in particular to those critics, I think, certainly they're trained or they did their, you know, degrees in other fields outside architecture. But the distinction I would make is that all of them, well, first, they're institutional platforms, and you would include Bob in this as well, right?
Fair enough.
Who's actually at least, you know, trained fully in another profession, right, before becoming involved in writing about architecture. Their platform remains within architecture. And academically, and that's their concern, is to write about the discourse. I'm saying, I'd be interested, and I don't know what the outcome would be. I'd be interested to see more writing where architecture is simply a marginal character, similar to some of the kind of history that both you and I do, but also that some of our peers do even more, where architecture is not the central object under discussion. But it's being taken up as a way to see and explain certain cultural parameters.
Architecture is such a good excuse to talk about so many things.
Yeah, and why does it always end up being
and
a discussion about architecture?
I know.
Well, it ends up being the reverse. It's almost as if, you know, people use art history to talk about architecture rather than architecture to talk about art history, right?
Well, but forget art history, which is itself a discipline.
You can think of a lot of other disciplines that are being used to talk about architecture, but very rarely the other way around.
Yeah. Well, I think in your architecture, you can talk about social
habits. You can talk about international organizations.
But all kinds of things, right? But it always ends up being a conversation about architecture.
Well, I think, but this is where maybe the architects themselves have to do a little bit of work, where this is why I was asking whether you thought that some of the discourse about the subconscious, this discourse about the discipline, would have to maybe take a back seat, in that it's an excuse for not having an overarching audience, basically. Sorry, I lost my train of thought. But.
No, it's well, it gives them a built-in audience, right? If that's the emphasis, then there's always a kind of
Oh, no, I remember. The agency of the architect. One of the things that's nice about the position that they do take, and we were saying that they take a relatively normative position, that they're architects, they build, they're not saying we're an institute, they're not saying we're a group or an avant-garde, we're an academy, they just say we're architects. One of the things that's liberating about that is that they don't fool themselves into thinking they have more power than they have. And that's the condition that this type of scholarship describes. Architects not as agents who shape society in this kind of fundamentally visionary way, but architects as, in a way, symptomatic. I mean, they shape things, but in a very sort of subtle, complicated way that says a lot about how things work in general.
Well, they're participants,
right?
Rather than
so, like, there's a difference between writing about Louis XIV and writing about his architect. And similarly, but you have to accept that, you know, his architect is not Louis XIV. Mm-hmm. But it seems like they're perfectly willing to accept that.
Yeah. No. And they now merit. They deserve a discussion and a kind of explanation commensurate to that.
I was just thinking that piece that was when Michael Meredith was in the LRB, and he was like the first word in that piece. It was, or something like that.
Yeah.
It was very early on.
Right.
But that doesn't really qualify, because that's more of a sort of cult of personality. He was a character. It wasn't
He was a character in that piece, although I mean, I think there was an oblique. It was, and it wasn't his architecture, but
exactly.
There was definitely the question there was, you know, does this person have a particular perspective that produces certain behaviors and attributes? And the answer was yes in that case. But then I guarantee you and I are the only people in all of like New England, North American academia who read
that. Who read that? No.
Yeah.
Well, Michael read it, I'm sure.
He did. He told me I was the first person to tell him I'd read it. So we can ask him if he's heard from anybody else.
I see.
Well, I haven't.
Yeah, see?
Oh, you should.
It's very funny.
It's very funny.
It's in the London Review of Books, it's someone that Michael had been when he was on at the Gandhi Foundation.
Gandhi
Foundation. One of his fellows who he traveled with drove back to the East Coast.
They drove back to the East Coast.
And it's the story
together.
Of them driving back to the East Coast.
That's better than a column called Michael Meredith is a friend of mine.
Absolutely.
We were saying we had this idea for a column of criticism that would just be called Blank is a friend of mine in every...
It's when we were discussing the question of friends, critics, and so on.
Yeah, Mark Wickley always had that thing in the assemblage discourse, which was always, you know, my friends ask me to write about them, but I say no, because then you do it once, and then it's dangerous. And so.
Okay.
I have to go to the airport.
I apologize, I missed the beginning of the conversation.
Well, it's recorded.
I know. I love how Ashley's saying off the record, like, we are the record. You get to edit the record, so you don't have to worry about it.
I was going to say, do we get to edit this as well?
Of course. Okay. Yeah.
All right, is that...
Have
you said everything you had to say?
I have said everything.
So where are you headed?
I'm going to Geneva. First I'm going to Zurich, then I'm going to Geneva to the conference and then archival work. I'm going to the League of Nations. Yeah. They closed the archives. All the you can turn that off now. The European archives closed.
Actually, I've learned not to turn it off because sometimes
every day they close at noon and they don't reopen for the afternoon. You mean?
No, no. They close at noon and reopen at 2 or something.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Kind of civilized. Yeah, you can't just go for a week and.
Right, you have to go for
2 weeks. I wrote that I was coming for a week and she was like, "You have this many linear feet of boxes to look at. I highly recommend you stay longer."
She knows exactly how many hours.
I think she doesn't know how much I've seen. Thank you for that.
Well, it's very interesting what I heard again. I'm sorry to be in another altered state, but
I'm sure that this is, it's like twice as many words as really needs to appear on paper.
Yeah, no, well.
We talk about
that. Editing is good.
Editing is good. What is the time frame for your.
The issue.
That's fine.
The issue.
We're shooting
to finish for the fall. So that's.
We should take a picture of them. Do you have a phone?
No, we're supposed to be taking pictures of the water bottles, the beverage bottles. That's what we decided. That was because we didn't do it at the beginning. Take the pictures of the people. So we figured the water bottles. Wait, your coffee cup too, I think.
Well, you have to make it look like the way you stage it, though.
Okay. But they're too far apart to get them all in one picture.
you literally just want the box.
We can't leave.
Yeah, I think we should take it.
And your coffee cup too.
Well, I don't know how to do what you're doing.
Okay, well, let's just stage it.
Isn't this the Corbusier thing? The cafe?
Fierce. You know, I've been looking everywhere. What book did it appear in? The hand pulling
out
of the wine.
The wine
is that the unité?
It's funny, I only have it for my slide.
It is, because the idea is that it's the...
Because I saw the one with the unité, but it's like...
That.
He did one that's more...
But when it's more...
When it's just the wine rack.
It's the filing cabinet.
Yeah,
so?
The
filing cabinet.
Have you looked in that issue of Grey Room that has the article... About the filing cabinet.
Yeah.
BBC's
You're right.
Obsession with the filing cabinet.
Okay.
That might be there and it might cite where it comes from.
Well, I would need it. I actually have to go.